We're going to go ahead and bring the committee back to order. Recess is over for at least the next hour and a half. We are on page 6 of the bill, line 11, heading into the discussion on rolled-in versus incremental rates. And if you could go ahead and probably best just to reintroduce yourself for the record so everything's picked up on the, and then yeah, if you could keep the mics fairly close because the keyboards with the background noise, sometimes it's hard to hear softer voices. And then we'll just roll through.
Okay. My name is Marcia Davis, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Revenue. And we are on section 7 on page 6, and this is the continuation of the list of items that must be contained in an application by a pipeline company. This list, or this particular item, relates to the manner in which the pipeline company will commit to handle the costs of future expansions of the pipeline. And there are essentially two ways that costs can be incurred and then passed on to the existing shippers in a pipeline. One of those means is known as incremental. And so what that means is the cost of the expansion, if it's X, gets borne by the new shippers, which is X, and the existing shippers have no cost, essentially. I mean, the incremental cost of adding that expansion is borne by the new shippers only. The other means of sharing cost is called rolled-in rates. And what that does is you take the existing cost structure, the new cost structure, add them together, and redivvy it up. And basically, existing shippers, new shippers, all bear this now different percentage share of a larger pie of costs. That's sort of the plain English way of looking at incremental costs versus rolled-in rates. And I'm sure my expert here might have a heart attack at some point, but I'll try it. The bill as originally proposed had set a cap. In other words, we tried to blend the way in which these costs would get borne because of concern that we wanted to make sure that future expansions of the pipelines could happen and happen more easily than they otherwise would if an expansionist, if a new shipper had to pay incremental cost. What we did is we asked that the pipeline company agree to allow a certain amount of cost sharing with existing shippers. In other words, a certain portion of the cost could get covered by rolled-in rates up to a point. And once you hit that point, then from then on, the extra costs that would get handled would be either incremental or rolled-in, whatever the preference or whatever was appropriate as proposed by the pipeline and what ultimately gets approved by FERC. Stepping back one step, one must remember that no matter what we write in this bill, well, no matter what we ask a pipeline to commit to propose to FERC, at the end of the day, FERC does what FERC is going to do. They will apply their rules and their regulations regarding what is an appropriate and fair manner of having costs borne by the shippers in a pipeline structure. And they will apply those rules and their policies in making that decision. What a pipeline company proposes certainly carries some weight, and what shippers argue about carries some weight, but ultimately FERC is the decider. So in AGEA, what we set up is a structure that requires a pipeline company to come forward and agree to allow rolled-in rate treatment for expansion costs up to 15% of a number. The original bill made that number 15% of the maximum initial recourse rate. And what that is for a pipeline company, the rack rate. If you were a guy on the street and you walked up to a pipeline and said, I'd like to ship some gas, what's your price? And like when you walk up to a hotel after you've driven all night and you walk in and say, tell me what your rate is, that's the rate you pay as a pipeline company, the rack rate or the maximum recourse rate. That was our cap. And what we heard as a result of following testimony was there were some pipeline companies that said, We've read that in your bill, and it gives us a little bit of heartburn because one of the things that we pride ourselves on doing well is negotiating rates. We like to encourage people to come in and ship gas on our pipeline by negotiating rates. And so when you've set your cap at 15% of this higher rack rate, you've sort of dissuaded people or taken away some of the oomph out of our negotiated rates. So we're a little concerned about that. So what we did is we went back, and in the course of the amendments on the Senate side, I'm not sure where that's coming from. Oh, my goodness gracious, I'm so sorry.
Donuts.
Just turn it off, yeah. No, it's off. It wasn't ringing, it's just making noise. What we decided to do was divvy that, break that maximum recourse rate into three categories. So what we have is 15% of the rack rate for someone who's paying the rack rate. That's now their cap for paying for expansion costs. Someone who was smart and negotiated a rate with a pipeline company, their maximum cap that they're going to face is 15% of their negotiated rate. And for someone who is in neither of those categories, meaning they came along later after the pipeline was built, and maybe they were in one of the first expansion shippers, and so their rate is sort of one of those weird ones, their cap is going to be a blend, a weighted blend of those two first categories. So what you see in this bill on page 6, which is Romanet I on line 21, which is 15% of the initial maximum recourse rate. In line 29, Romanet 2, which is 15% above the negotiated rate. On page 7, line 8, Romanet 3, which is 115% of the volume weighted average of all rates. Those are the three categories of caps that would be supported by a pipeline company for future expansion costs and the manner in which those will be handled.
So could you maybe take the time, or Anthony, to explain FERC's historic methodology in the states versus the special treatment that Alaska's going to receive?
I'll let Anthony introduce himself and then respond to that.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. My name is Anthony Scott. I'm a commercial analyst with the Division of Oil and Gas. Historically, up until I believe the mid-1990s, FERC's favored policy in the lower 48 was a presumption in favor of rolled-in rates. With the recognition of an increasingly competitive gas pipeline sector in the lower 48, where you had producing and final demand markets being served by multiple pipelines, FERC adopted a policy actually in favor of incremental rate treatment unless rolling in the rates reduced rates for initial shippers. For the Alaska pipeline project in FERC order 2005 and 2005A, FERC adopted a rebuttable presumption in favor of rolled in rates for this project, in recognition of the fact that there will be no competition, almost certainly, for moving gas out of Alaska by pipeline. And given Congress's desire to ensure that the pipeline promoted exploration and development of North Slope resources, FERC adopted a rebuttable presumption in favor of rolled-in rates. I will also add that rolled-in rates are is the standard policy in Canada, has been for decades. It's led to enormous growth of the pipeline grid and pipeline gas exploration and development in Alberta. Does that answer your question, Senator?
Partway. I wasn't really thinking about the Canadian issue, but my understanding is that Canada has a different required rates of return on some of their investments, and can you highlight that at all? Or?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, Mr. Chairman. as I understand it, in general, in Canada, rates are revisited each and every year. Rates of return tend to be lower because of that. The pipeline company faces less risk of recovering their investment and accordingly, their rates of return that are allowed by the Canadian regulatory body, the NEB, tend to be lower than those provided by the FERC.
Could you give us a range, both in the what would be a reasonable assumption for the gas line we're talking about, and then what would be reasonable expectations in Canada?
I'm hesitant to speak about the Canadian side just because I'm less familiar, but I'm happy to get some data to you on that shortly. On the U.S. side, in initial certification proceedings, a 14% rate of return for the maximum or recourse rate for the first several years of pipeline operation would be not at all unusual. In fact, it would be the norm given the kind of debt equity ratios that we're discussing here. Given litigated rate outcomes some years into a pipeline's operation, one often sees those rates of return numbers come down from a level of, say, 14% to rough numbers, 12%. In general, rates of return on Canadian pipes tend to be lower than that. Not a lot, but somewhat lower. And again, before I misspeak and get it wrong, I'd prefer to go back and check and get a more firm number for you on Canadian regulated rates of return.
Okay. The issue of the impact on the tariff due to expansions, first compression and then looping, there's been varying testimony as far as the tariff going down or going up. As nobody said, it'll stay flat. It's only thing in the middle. And then my understanding is from the Resources Committee, and I don't know what was testified at Judiciary, but you were going to bring back some modeling and give us some more in-depth analysis on what, you know, would be a reasonable expectation on the tariff with the expansion of, if we had this hypothetical line of 6.5 to 6.5.
Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, there will be a future session later in the week, say Monday. I don't know what your schedule is, but I'm more than happy to present a number of different scenarios and model returns. I will say this, that in the work that we've done, as well as the testimony that you've received in terms of the likely rate impacts, the answer is, of course, it depends, and it depends on a couple of things. Importantly, the rate impacts in terms of the cost of expansion depend on the timing of the expansion. The further in the future it occurs, the more expensive the expansion will be. At least that's what we predict. If you look at the last 15 years or so, there is significant real price escalation in compression. Compressors are, compared to the economy as a whole, getting more and more expensive. So a 1 BCF expansion that occurs after 2 years will be, in nominal dollar terms and actually in real dollar terms, less expensive than a 1 BCF expansion that occurs on day one, or a 1 BCF expansion that occurs after, day one will be the cheapest. After 2 years, it'll get more expensive. 5 years, it's more expensive still. The other factor, and it's related in terms of the cost of expansion, has to do with the cost of fuel. If one presumes that at a minimum gas prices will escalate with inflation, and we are modeling here nominal dollar tariff effects, so the 15% cap is a 15% cap measured in nominal dollars, that is money of the day from the beginning when the pipeline goes into operation. If that expansion does not occur, say the first one, for 10 years, imagine that was the case. If the cost of gas in real terms stays constant, even it's just escalating only with inflation, the relative cost of fuel burn is increasing over time relative to that 15% cap. I believe that you've heard testimony, for example, from TransCanada, who said, you don't need to worry about rolled-in rates. It's a sunny day. You know, we can get through looping without any rate increase compared to the initial rate. But my good friend Tony Palmer also is more than happy to explain that that assumption, in terms of rate impacts, presumes that all of those expansions occur at in-service. So they occur right up front in the beginning. And the expansion scenarios that we will present to you later on in the week do not assume that. We assume that expansions occur over time. And so, final point on expansions and rate impacts is, if you predict high costs of fuel, that is high gas prices, the tariff consequences in a high gas price world would be bigger, just because if fuel use goes up by a percentage point for everybody, but gas is valued at $8, that 1% is worth a lot more than if gas is valued at $4.
Marcia, you want to continue, please?
Sure. On bottom of page 7, line 29 is the next listed item in the application requirements. And this is a requirement that was, I believe, added in one, maybe in Senate Resources, and that was a desire to ensure that we were discussing and dealing with the North Slope Gas Treatment Plant. Because when the project was originally, when the AGEA was originally drafted, recall, the focus was the construction of a pipeline. And we were not making it a requirement that the pipeline builder supply also a gas treatment plant. But we certainly needed to evaluate, if they did build a plant, what the plant was like, and if they didn't build a plant, in order to assess the likelihood of success of the project, where would the plant come from? So this item was added to address in the application the requirement that they disclose what their plans were with respect to having a gas treatment plant. Because there's a distinct possibility that a gas treatment plant on the North Slope would in some way engage or involve infrastructure that already exists there on the slope, particularly at Prudhoe Bay, we wanted to also ensure that if an applicant was putting in gas treatment plant facilities that included facilities that already existed, there's a provision in here on line 6, page 8, that requires that if assets are committed to the gas treatment plant that are already owned, that they'll be committed at net book value so that they aren't put in at replacement value, in other words, brand new costs that would then have to be put against the tariff rate. We wanted at least the benefit of book value in the calculation of the tariff rate.
One of the other issues while we're on the gas treatment plant is the interrelationship with the PPT tax and the 20% credit, and we had a lot of discussion at this table dealing with that under the PPT legislation and under the, you know, this different concept that we had several months ago dealing with the gas line. And I'd like the administration to come back to us with some information on how that credit is or is not applicable to the GTP plant, so it's understood by everybody at the table.
Senator Steadman, we can do that because it was flagged early on. We have been looking at that.
Mr. Chairman, I will say this, in the economics that we've run for various committees, we have always assumed that the GTP did not qualify for PPT credits. That was just a modeling assumption. I don't know if it's correct under the law at all, but I'm just letting you know what our assumptions were.
Yeah, we'll find out. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the top of page 8, the area that you're talking about now, is some of this in attempt to get a handle on maybe when you say existing, when you're talking about the gas treatment plant, are you also talking about gathering lines that might exist that would be used in conjunction with this, maybe that already exist from some distance even that might be previously used in other capacity?
Senator Thomas, you raise a good point in terms of gathering lines. Right now, I believe, in terms of gas treatment plant, we've been looking at it as being post-production treatment. So depending upon how gas is transiting across the North Slope to what would be the gas treatment plant. I tend to think of gathering lines as going from wellhead to a processing center, and in most fields, that processing is an initial processing that wouldn't be considered part of the gas treatment plant. However, one could envision gas going from another unit to this location where it would have already undergone processing at the, you know, for the initial processing, and that a line would transit to the gas treatment plant. And I believe that, you know, could be a question as to whether that line should be considered a FERC line or not, but those are the issues that we are trying to look at in the application process.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Subsection 9 is a requirement that the applicant state what percentage and the total dollar amount they are seeking under their application for the state's matching contribution that was described earlier as the $500 million. So this is the opportunity for the applicant to, one, be competitive, and two, state how much of the state's money they are looking to receive and over what time frame based on the match for their project, proposed project. So this brings out that detail. Subsection 10 on line 14 of page 8 is the obligation on the part of the applicant to commit that for rate making purposes they will only include a 70% debt structure. Again, this is one of the must-have elements that the administration has identified as important for purposes of ensuring reasonable tariff structures. This is a not less than 70%, so an applicant is in a position where they could propose a higher debt element that would essentially lower the rates.
Why, on that particular issue, Marshall, why wouldn't we use the 80-20?
Why would we not use the 80-20?
Right, to get the tariff down and then deal with cost overruns with some mechanism yet to, we haven't got to that for you to talk about that.
I know that 80-20 is the construct or the presumption for the federal loan guarantees. However, in our reviews, we felt that we wanted to cast as broad a net as we could and not keep people from coming in the door simply because we set the threshold too high for their particular structure. We recognize that obviously 80-20 is better for the state from an NPV analysis if you look at the tariff structure than a 70-30. However, we felt 70-30 would have a broader net and we would still be in a position to evaluate which applicant would be superior, and it certainly isn't something that would cause someone to assume that everybody's coming in at 7:30. They can assume someone's going to be at 75 and somebody's going to be at 80, so we still have the competitive forces that would force them up from 70 if they're concerned. But you're right, it is a number that we've selected just based on a criteria of trying to be broader than narrower here.
Just the term must have makes me kind of curious. Must have as far as an equity position, no more than 30, but is it a must have that we can't change that 30 to 25 or 20?
Oh, no. In terms of not less than 70, which is the countervailing of not more than 30, then that means as long as it's not more than 30, it could be 25, it could be 20, depending on what they bid.
I'm talking about in the bill itself.
Oh, well, certainly it's the prerogative of the legislature and certainly the Finance Committee if you know, to pick whatever number you're going to pick because it's a bill that you're going to pass. But the administration is recommending 70-30 just from a standpoint of...
Could you explain to the committee what... ability FERC has in this debt-to-equity rate setting, not so much for the internal financing or the construction, but actually in the calculation of the tariff?
I would have to get back to you on that, Senator Stedman, with one of our FERC people, one of our experts on how they take debt equity and build that into a tariff structure.
And if
it's a multi-factored analysis, but that is one of the key pieces they look at for determining.
And if FERC could arbitrarily set the rate, it wouldn't be arbitrary set, but would set a rate that may not be indicative of the debt equity on any particular project. As an example, if FERC decided that they wanted to only count 25% of the equity, even though there was 30% put in, can they set the rate structure, the tariff structure, at 25 or 35?
Senator Stedman, I believe that they can, which is why we've limited this for rate-making purposes. It's my understanding that an applicant could, in fact, in reality, have a debt structure that might be 50% debt and 50% equity, in reality, on their books and how they're structuring their deal. But when they go to FERC, they would represent it as a 70% debt. In other words, they would only offer up for recovery, for return on their equity, the 30% equity that they have, notwithstanding the fact they actually have 50% equity in the project.
Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marcia, taking the 70% debt, and if you go back to the purpose statement, which element number three is maximize benefits to the people, it appears that, to me at least, that the debt equity is such an important piece to the maximum value to the people that if somebody came in with an 80-20 proposal, they would almost have to win, assuming they're halfway functionally adequate in the rest of their contract or their application, because it, the maximum piece is so important in rate setting.
Senator Huggins, through the chair, you may very well be right that it's maybe the core swing in terms of where the MPV value is to the state. But I guess I want to hold out some thought that there may be other elements that get put into an application that might affect the MPV as well that maybe we're not even contemplating. Remember, these are minimum requirements, and you could have an applicant come in that offers up additional structures or additional benefits to the state that go beyond the minimums that might counterbalance a difference in the debt equity rate. So I'm not positive that that would happen, but it could. But you're right, you've identified one of the key elements.
Yeah.
Senator Huggins.
What? No, I understand, which gets me to my next question. Can we as a state set the threshold as low as 70%? I mean, aren't we bound by a higher number if it's such a strong element of the value?
I know that the gas team, when they did their evaluation, did their numbers based on the 70% and looked at the MPV values to the state over that range. And if the body is desirous, we could come in and maybe show 70 versus 80% and how much of a swing that is to inform you in deciding whether or not that was a jump that you felt you needed to make.
Yeah, thank you. I that may be important for us, Mr. Chairman, in the respect that, I mean, I don't want to guess us violating the maximum benefit if it, in fact, is a corollary. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay.
Please continue.
On page 18, line 18, page 8, is listed item 11. Which is essentially the manner in which the applicant proposes to manage cost overruns. This is important, obviously, because the ability of an applicant to show that they have cost containment capabilities, they have, in addition, the measures that they propose to mitigate the effects of overruns. Part of the negotiated approach to bringing in shippers may involve the sharing of the risk of cost overruns. So we're very interested to hear what an applicant has to say in the complete world of overruns, because it is very, very important. That's probably one of the key factors that shippers will look to when they decide whether or not to participate at an open season. Item listed item 12 at line 21 on page 8 is the commitment by the applicant to provide a minimum of 5 delivery points of natural gas in this state. And again, this is essentially locking in the obligation of the applicant to ensure that there are adequate offtake points within the state. And we're not asking them to identify where those are in the application, as we believe the location and the sizing of those will need to be fleshed out subsequent to the application process in negotiation with various in-state users.
And on the point of five, is there any analysis that derives the position of five, or?
I believe the gas team was looking at prior projects that had been proposed in the state, some of the in-state gas line suggestions, either through ANGDA or the bullet projects, et cetera, and they were looking to ensure that they had at least as many identified as had been identified in those projects, plus a couple, I think.
I think there was three identified on the last proposal in the previous administration, and four total.
Right.
Three can be identified. One was in we don't know where, and now we're looking at five. So
we're
just
a
looking at
header.
The rationale of the numbers.
Right. I think it was just three plus a couple extra for good measure. Listed
just
item.
A second, okay. Marshall. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you say provide for a minimum of five delivery points, what do you envision that being? Somebody just identifying an area where it would be, or do you see ultimately the potential for some structure being or something being altered in the line itself, valve in place or something like that?
At the point in time that they file their application, this is simply going to be their commitment that they will make available five, at least a minimum of five offtake points without identifying their precise location. It could be that there's an applicant involved that already has aligned themselves with a spur project, for instance, in which case they will have a project that sits on it when it comes in with some specific offtake points identified. But it will depend on the applicant and what their specific project is as to whether they'll have specific offtake points identified or not. But we're not requiring that as part of the application process. Just simply that they have committed that they will make at least five offtake points available.
Just wanted to say, did you explore the engineering difference between an oil offtake point and a natural gas offtake point?
I think it was just simply gas offtake, since this is the focus of a gas line, recognizing that, you know, it has its engineering and technical challenges. And that's why we didn't want to just leave it to voluntarily agreeing later on that there'd be offtake points. So we at least wanted to put a stake in the sand and said you will make 5 points available, notwithstanding the challenges.
Okay, thank you.
The next listed item that must be in the application is item 13 at line 23, page 8. And this is actually the obligation to offer firm transportation points service to the delivery points as part of their tariff. And this is the element that requires them to provide distance-sensitive rates to delivery points in the state. And if I'll let, I thought that was Anthony sitting there. Sorry. The point of this is to ensure that when gas is taken off in the state, it obviously is along for the ride, for a very short part of the ride, compared to gas that goes all the way to Chicago, for instance, or Alberta, and from Alberta down into the lower 48. And so this is an obligation on the part of the ship, of the pipeline company, to help us negotiate distance-sensitive rates that ensure that the shipper of gas in-state bears only their fair share or fair proportion of costs under the federal requirements for that transport, so that they don't get loaded on and, in essence, end up paying some of the costs for other shippers for longer distance. Recognizing, however, it will be more expensive for gas to come off in the state because you have occupied capacity to that point in state and essentially required re-engineering or smaller pipe, if you imagine a telescoping pipe moving its way through the process as gas comes off. You know, there are engineering ways to mitigate the extra cost, but if you don't have a way to mitigate that cost, you've essentially stranded some space in that pipe as it goes on further. So recognizing there'll be some higher cost, this is a way to mitigate that to some extent by complying with this provision and FERC provision. Listed item 14 on line 28 is the obligation for the applicant to establish a local headquarters in the state for the proposed project. And this is envisioned to be a construction project headquarters. Item 15 has been improved over the course of its handling by the legislature. And this starts on line 30, page 8, and continues through to line 7 on page 9. And this is essentially the obligation to hire Alaska residents throughout the state, utilize Alaska businesses, utilize hiring facilities within the state, the job centers, and the Department of Labor Workforce Development Programs. So again, this is the Jobs for Alaskan section, but within boundaries as permitted by law. Paragraph 16 is a provision that was added in the Senate Judiciary, and this provision is the waiver by the applicant of the right to appeal the issuance of a license and the appeal of a determination that no license should be issued. And the concerns expressed during the Senate Judiciary was a desire to ensure that there was not litigation that delayed the project, that the process moved smoothly as we could possibly make it within the bounds of due process and legal requirements. So this provision has a waiver by the applicants of the right to challenge the issuance of the licenses. Paragraph 17 is basically the project labor agreement provision, and this is a commitment by the applicant to negotiate a project labor agreement. And a project labor agreement here is defined as a comprehensive collective bargaining agreement between the licensee or its agent and the appropriate labor representatives to ensure expedited construction with labor stability for the project by qualified residents of the state.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Dalton.
Thanks, and thanks, Marcia. I'm assuming that number 17 only applies to the initial construction, would not apply, for example, to looping that might take place at some time in the future?
Right now, as written, it's a commitment to negotiate before construction a project labor agreement. And so you'd essentially be looking at needing to do it for the construction phase. I would assume that any subsequent agreements by the pipeline company would be what it would individually choose to negotiate. If it found that that was a conducive process and it was one that gave them efficient access to labor, et cetera, then they may choose to expand it beyond that. But right now, this bill only relates to the construction.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I know. Listed item 18, line 17, page 9, is the commitment that they, once they receive the state's matching contribution, we wanted to ensure that the benefit to the state of having paid that money is that it would, in fact, be applied and reduce equity and therefore lower the tariff costs for the state. So we wanted to make sure that that got applied against the rate base, and this ensures that it does.
Could you bring back to the committee the analysis showing the benefits of that? I know there was a slide at resources, mm-hmm. and maybe the same slide at
yes.
judiciary for Leno, but one of the concerns we have or interests we have that we maximize our bang for our buck for Alaskans and that our $500 million, rather than being applied to the offset the tariff of which most of the benefit appears to go to whoever has most of the gas in the line, which won't be the state, that there may be some other use, as an example, to offset the cost of a line into Anchorage or down into the peninsula.
Yes, Senator Stedman, we can bring that slide forward. One of the challenges is when we look at the $500 million, the direct benefit to the state, as you've correctly noted, as far as tariff relief, might amount to perhaps $200 million over project life, and that the tariff reduction for others is received by them. But we also have the add-on effect that once that other party has the reduced tariff costs, that in turn increases the state's royalty and tax take as well because there's lower deductions against them. So it's sort of a direct and indirect impacts that we see rippling through.
There's also been some interest in possibly turning that into an equity position or an equity option, mm-hmm. therefore allowing the state to recoup its capital and then apply it, as an example, to subsidize a line that will directly benefit mm-hmm. more Alaskans.
We'll bring that back, Senator Stubbe. Paragraph 19 is a requirement that was actually picked up on the House side and adopted by the Senate, and this is on line 20, page 9. And this was a request that the applicant more carefully identify who the participants were in the application. Again, a concern was that you might have an applicant that listed that it had the participation of an ANCSA corporation, another applicant listing that they had also the participation of a different ANCSA corporation, and as you evaluate sort of the economic impacts, the what benefits are being brought into the state through infusion of capital with Alaska businesses, you want to be able to see what level of participation that is. For instance, an applicant that has only a 0.004% partner as opposed to a applicant who has a 25% Alaska partner, you know, that might weigh differently in the way you evaluate the applications.
Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last year at this table, there was some concern about the financial viability of the affiliates, and we're really looking to make sure that the parent companies were on the hook. Your nod makes me think you know what I'm talking about. So would you care to answer the question I've asked?
Yes.
Please.
Yes. Part of the requirement that we were covering earlier was the economic and technical viability, as well as on page 4 at the top of the page, analysis demonstrating the project's economic viability and technical viability. And certainly we're going to be looking for the financial solvency and integrity of that business. Likewise, if we low down, I think we had something in here. In the evaluation criteria, we're going to have a basis for evaluating the financial solvency and integrity of that applicant. So with this provision requiring them to identify all of the participants so we know who they are, then within the evaluation criteria, we'll be able to gauge their solvency and whether it's a solid basis, a solid financial entity, or whether it's a shell. That's obviously what you want to make sure of, is that you aren't putting forward sort of shell companies that can't stand behind the obligations they make.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Please continue.
Finally, item 20 is going to be the list that essentially lets, any other way that the applicant can demonstrate that they are ready and able to perform their plan. So those are the 20 listed items that must be in an application or required to be in the application. That's not to say that all 20 have equal importance, but each of them is important in its own right.
And is it also accurate to say if they miss any one of those, how is that handled?
If an applicant were to submit an application and the commissioners in their review of it determined that they could not find support for one of these elements, then the commissioners would make a solicitation for additional information to that applicant in the process and say, we don't see this particular information, can you please provide it? And the applicant would have an opportunity to come forward and either provide something or, you know, basically supplant what's missing. If at the end of the day an element is missing, then that application is not complete and it would not be considered in the ranking criteria, in the ranking and the evaluation.
Even if the net present value is substantially higher to the state than the other applicant?
Well, the net present value wouldn't have been calculated until you get a complete application. How about that for a math answer? I'm sorry. I mean, essentially, obviously, you're going to look at something that you can maybe eyeball and go, wow, that would really be great. And if it's missing a one of the criteria and the commissioners can't say it's complete, then yes, it would lead to the conclusion that you'd say, gee, I can't consider that.
Will the legislature have the ability then to look and review the applications that were disqualified to have those calculations run?
Yes, they will, Senator Stebbins. What we have is a provision in here that's going to authorize the legislative body, the legislators, to sign a confidentiality agreement that will allow them from the very beginning to look at all information that is supplied by applicants to the commissioners and from the get-go. So that would include applications that were subsequently determined incomplete. So the legislature would be seeing that as well.
It was Senator Elton. Did you have?
I did. I don't necessarily know how to ask the question, but and it's a process question. As you're evaluating, I'm assuming that you're going to apply the standards that are applied to other RFPs, for example. And the reason I'm asking is if you look at number 19 on the list of 20, it says provide a detailed description. And I mean, detailed can be defined differently. So if somebody, for example, a potential applicant for the license says, well, what do you mean by detailed? I mean, do you then respond to that person and all of the other applicants? And who's in charge of making those decisions?
Senator Elton, through the chair, I agree that this will be handled probably very similar to other RFP processes. You want to have an above board fair process with good due process. And so the administration will be preparing an RFA, which will identify all of the information in fuller detail than is set forth in this bill of what needs to be in the application. Having submitted that, putting that out to the public, we would envision that we would start to receive questions from potential applicants asking information about that RFA and its process. And I would fully anticipate that the two commissioners would set up a process whereby those questions would be received and responded to in a broadcast way. So you'd set up a website where questions might come in, and then that answer and that information would flow out to all potential applicants so that everyone receives the same information and the same level of guidance as the process unfolds.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please continue.
Section 140, which is the title, is at the bottom of page 9 on line 31, and it's the initial application review, additional information requests, and it continues. The body of that section is on page 10. This sets up the process whereby commissioners receive and review the applications submitted and make a determination as to whether those applications are complete. In other words, do they have all of the required information listed in 130. They evaluate them, and to the extent information is missing, they may request that additional information from the applicant, and they'll set a time frame within which to respond. Part of the concern that was expressed earlier on in the earlier version of AGEA was that we weren't tying the information request to the application, and there was concern that perhaps this could be used as a fishing expedition. That wasn't the intent. So we've amended this language to make it very clear that the additional information relates to the application.
And then on line 4, the second word in, mm-hmm. which is the commissioner shall reject versus may reject. Why do we want to tie the commissioner into such a structural process versus use the word may so he can derive the highest net present value that some creative minds can put together for the benefit of the state?
Very good question. We actually had this discussion last night in the House. I think there was a suggestion that word shall be turned to may. And Commissioner Galvin answered it last night, and I didn't hear his answer, so I'm going to answer it today and take a chance and see if we have the same answer. The reason that we feel it should be shall is because when you put may, you've essentially put a discretion upon the commissioners to decide when they will decide to reject an application for being incomplete and when they will not. And that standard, without a written standard of what will guide that discretion, when do they choose to ignore it, when do they choose not to? And that can lead to, I mean, you're basically buying a lawsuit at that point for any application you do reject as incomplete, when in fact you allow in one or more applications that was incomplete, but you've allowed it in. So that level of legal uncertainty and that level of challenge could essentially put us way behind as far as from a constitutional standpoint. I would see that as a constitutional argument. And I'll let Commissioner Galvin add his reasons why he thinks it should be shall and not may.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Pat Galvin, Commissioner of Revenue. This particular question drives at the heart of AGIA. It's a question of whether the state is actually going to have must-have provisions in the bill, or whether they're going to be mere recommendations or requests. We feel that it's imperative that AGIA contain the state's must-have provisions, that if you fail to meet these requirements, you're not going to be considered. It is part of the communication that is set up by AGIA that the state, through this vehicle, is saying, this is our bottom line, this is what we have to have in order for a participant to be considered. We do not believe that there is a provision within our must-have list that is commercially unreasonable or is not appropriate for the state to request in response to what we're putting out there on the table. And we believe that it would strike at the heart of the purpose of AGIA if we were to soften the message when it comes to our initial request and to say that there are certain things that the state has to have unless you feel that we should consider something else. And it's the nature of a discussion and negotiation is you say, this is our bottom line and that's it, as opposed to this is our bottom line and we can continue to talk about it. Within the context of AGIA, the state has to have must-haves. If there's something within that list of 20 items that the legislature feels is inappropriate, is potentially a hurdle to getting the applications that we want, then let's talk about those provisions. But we do not believe that there is one within the list that should be negotiated or amended if the legislature and the administration decided it is a must-have. And so we feel very strongly that AGIA would not be what it is if we were to change that provision.
Item 16 of the must-haves is a waiver of right to appeal the issuance of the license. So if, to Marcia's comment about creating litigation, don't they give up that right under 16?
Senator Stedman, constitutional arguments can't really be waived. And so with respect to process, you know, whether we violated our provisions, et cetera, that can be certainly waived and given up. If someone's saying you made the wrong choice, you made the wrong net present value evaluation, you failed to consider information that was in our application, you know, those things will be waived. But if someone wants to attack on a constitutional basis, then conceivably that might still be there.
And Mr. Chair, just to follow up with all due respect to Marsh, that's not the driving. I mean, the question about constitutionality and the discretionary authority of the commissioners in going from shall to may is not the driving factor in our insistence on it being shall. It's strictly, as I stated, we have to have must-haves in this bill in order to be able to get what we want out of this process.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had the same question and was looking at your language and also 16, but that's right. You probably can't preclude people from suing you. They'll always find a way to do that in some fashion. But my question was more to the concept of just when the rejection is made. Is there some, will there be a procedure where you notify somebody that they are inadequate in their proposal or something like that and believe that they've maybe overlooked, or will it simply be a rejection of that proposal on its first?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, on page 10, line 6, as you're evaluating applications, you can evaluate an application. The commissioners may request additional information from the applicant. So we would envision this provision as being one where we will reach out and try to save applications that are missing critical information by requesting additional information. If it's a situation of not omission of information, but just simply, sorry, we're giving you an application that has a 50% debt and not the 70% debt, that's not really an omission. You know, they've sort of decided not to comply with that particular criteria.
If I may, I was a little concerned that that B said not rejected, so I wasn't sure if that, you know.
Right. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, it could be that we could word that a little more artfully.
Anyhow.
That might be something we could look at just to clarify, because it is the intent. I mean, we obviously want to ensure that no application is rejected because of some inadvertency on the part of an applicant or a belief that they adequately treated a topic and we determined we needed more information.
Thank you.
Senator Hill.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And going back to the language on line four, the shall reject. Does that preclude the state, after a license is awarded, to sitting down with the licensee and saying, you know, we really liked this provision that another applicant had. Would you consider adding it to your proposal? As long as it was an addition rather than a subtraction, is that allowed?
Senator Elton, through the chair. Once we have selected an application and made the determination that it is ranked first place on the criteria that you're going to see here shortly, there is the ability of both the licensee and the state to modify a project plan if it meets the criteria. And one of the criteria is improving the net present value to the state. You know, and the other two probably wouldn't apply in the circumstance you're talking about. So the question would be, I'm not sure what leverage the state would have on an applicant who's successful and has won to make further changes that would further enhance the state's position, unless it could do so without resulting in, you know, harm or a loss of value to itself. But otherwise, simply going to an applicant before we've made the selection and going to them saying, gee, we'd like to, you know, see if you can change your application to make it better, I think that would be improper.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Section 150 is the proprietary information and trade secrets section, and it starts on line 15, page 10. And the purpose of this section is to allow applicants to provide information in their application that they consider to be valuable and important in the evaluation and in their competitive standing, but that may be commercially sensitive or have a trade secret status. So what the process described here is that the applicant submits information, they label whatever information they would like to have treated as proprietary or as a trade secret. The commissioners get that, review it, and make a determination as to whether they agree that that information should be given that status. If they disagree, they will so notify the applicant and allow the applicant to take that information back if they choose, or choose to leave the information in the application knowing that it will not be treated as confidential. An applicant who wins and is selected as a licensee, their information will be completely opened up. There will be no information retained as confidential proprietary in a winning bid. For a challenger, and again, this is a person who challenges the award of a license to another person, and this may again be something we want to look at changing if we've now removed the ability to challenge and to protest. But we had information before that allowed that information likewise to be made public if someone challenged the process, because we didn't want them sort of shooting from the weeds at the winning project.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah. It perhaps is unlikely, but is there proprietary information that would be submitted with the bid, particularly discussing the business relationships, affiliates, and all that sort of thing, that a company might be reluctant to submit because then if they won, they would have to declare all that would become public information? Or am I misreading this?
What we are seeing, and from the experience of our FERC and our pipeline people, the kind of information that most likely would be sought to be treated as proprietary are some of the commercial arrangements that a pipeline company enters into or makes with shippers that enables them, they feel gives them a competitive advantage in lining up and acquiring shippers. And that's the type of information they would not want to let out if they were not the successful bidder. Obviously, if they're the successful bidder, that information will be out in public filings with FERC, et cetera, so that arrangement will be made known. But it's when they are unsuccessful and they want to take that same bag of tricks and go off and try to compete for another project that they want to keep it under wraps and at least have that as an advantage to them as they cost and come up with sort of what they think the project economics are. As far as your what you've outlined is relationships amongst affiliates and those types of business ties, we're not seeing that as the type of information that would have the sensitivity that they'd be worried about.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Section 160 at the top of page 11 is the notice, review, and comment section. And this provision is important in that this is the one where the commissioners publish notice and provide the public a 60-day review and opportunity to comment on all of the applications. Until the applications are determined complete, they aren't posted, but once they're deemed complete and you've got the applications lined up that the commissioners are going to rank and evaluate, those are the ones that get put online. Well, I say online, some fashion, we're going to have to make them available to the public for comment. In addition, this provision under C, line 12, is an important addition which allows the legislators to become engaged in this process from the get-go. And this is the provision that allows them to review all information that's been submitted to the commissioners. Section 170 is the application evaluation and ranking provision. This is on line 19, page 11. This is a very important provision, and it's a provision that has gotten a lot of attention on both the House and the Senate side to this point because it's the provision that sets out the criteria, the manner in which the projects will essentially be ranked. And the key structure of this is that the commissioners have two different sets of criteria they're going to use to arrive at the net present value of the project to the state and the likelihood of success of the project. So under B, subsection B, line 26 lists the criteria that are going to be used by the commissioners in evaluating the net present value of the cash flow. And one of the revisions to this was a request by the legislators that the commissioners use an analysis that includes an undiscounted value and, at a minimum, discounted rates of 2%, 6%, and 8% as they evaluate the net present value of the project to the state. The criteria that they're going to be looked at are listed in 1 through 5, but those are essentially the criteria that relate to project economics, the timeliness of the project, the netback of the value of the gas, the cost overruns, the initial design capacity, which defines the volume of gas, and other factors that are found relevant. And other factors would include, for instance, the amount of the matching contribution that was requested from the state. Subsection C on page 8 of line 12 lists the likelihood of success factors, and those are listed in 1 through 6. And again, these are going to be an evaluation that is based on the expertise that the commissioners bring to bear on the analysis of the application. They have a right to retain contractors, and there will be a lot of expertise brought in to ensure that intelligent judgments are made about the application and not simply taking the applications at face value. And we're going to be analyzing the reasonableness, the specificity, the feasibility of the work plans, the timelines, the budgets. Item 2, line 15, Senator Dyson, is the financial resources of the applicant, the ability of the applicant to comply with the proposed performance schedule, their organization, their experience, their accounting, their operational skills, and their record, track record. including their integrity and their business ethics, and any other factors that the commissioners are going to find relate to the evaluation of a project's likelihood of success.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we go back, Marcia, to line 13, it says, encourage shippers to participate other than what's in a GEO, which is for incentives and mandated things. Could you give me about three or four things that do that?
Well, in the context of this sentence, the focus is on cost overruns primarily, I think. Insulate the shippers from the effects of cost overruns and encourage shippers to participate in the first binding open season. Other things in addition to cost overruns are obviously relate again within that project, within that paragraph, to the degree of specificity in the work plan, the degree of the technical quality of the design parameters of the pipeline. The shippers are going to be looking for how sure, how solid is the estimate for the cost, and therefore how solid is the estimate for the tariff that they're being offered in an open season. And those are the kinds of things that are going to encourage a shipper to want to participate or not participate in open season.
I guess, if I might, Mr. Chair, given that that's from the shipper's perspective, do you expect to confer with the shipper on that? Were they encouraged or not?
Senator Huggins, during an open season, it is a commercial, to some extent, negotiation. As you're moving to an open season, there's continuing discussions between the pipeline company and the shippers with regard to what types of arrangements should be made within the open season in order to increase the attractiveness of the open season to those particular shippers. What we would be evaluating is the plan that the pipeline company provides us in terms of how they're going to get the most attractive open season terms that they can provide at that time. And some of it is going to be spelled out in the application directly, and it will likely be some of the things that Marcia referred to earlier as far as proprietary types of arrangements that they are willing to offer to the shippers that they've used in other places that have created an attractive open season. Others may be things that they intend to investigate with regard to those discussions with shippers, that they'll be exploring different things that may be of interest to the shippers, but they won't be able to tell us up front if they're actually going to offer them, because it's going to depend upon that response that they get from the shippers. But it's going to be a combination of things that they can tell us up front. We believe these things are going to provide value, and there are going to be other things that they're going to say, we're going to explore these ideas with potential shippers as we move closer to that open season.
Senator Huggins, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In that respect, if a party, use your imagination, comes forward and says part of their application says, I have under these conditions an agreement that the shippers are going to commit. My assumption, the party almost wins, assuming everything else being equal. Is that a true statement?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, certainly that increases the evaluation of the likelihood of success of that project, assuming all things being equal, if they have a solid construction plan, timeliness is good. In other words, the net present value to the state looks good.
Right.
Certainly having shippers lined up or as part of your application certainly helps you with the likelihood of success element, but it's not the sole element. There are other parts of the evaluation criteria.
And Senator Huggins, through the chair, I would venture not to equivocate as much. If all things else being equal, somebody else comes in and says, I've got a commitment that I'm going to get the gas, and somebody else says, well, these are the things I'm going to try to do to get the gas, the first guy wins.
Okay. Yeah, but let me ask one more time. Are there, I understand the elements of, you know, whether or not the work plan, the timeline, the budget, things of that nature. Are there other elements you visualize that would be encouraging, using that operational term, that
I imagine if I thought long enough and hard enough, I might be able to come up
okay.
with a couple
Let's
of
move
them.
On.
Nothing jumping up
okay.
the top of okay. my head.
Senator Huggins, to the chair, we'd be happy to get some of our commercial folks to come up with some ideas. Some of the consultants that we have who've worked on other pipelines in the lower 48 can provide you with some of the terms. I know on Rockies Express, there's a number of different provisions that were offered to the shippers to insulate them with regard to some risks or provide them with some beneficial services that they wouldn't otherwise have. And we can provide you with examples of those to give you a sense of the types of arrangements that are made between the pipeline and the shippers.
Right. Yeah. And if I might, Mr. Chairman, I just think it's important elements that, you know, offer encouragement, you know, seals the deal. I mean, you name your description. I mean, the longer the list of that and the more specificity you have, I think, in my estimation at least, the greater likelihood of us being able, number one, to meet those terms or at least seek those terms. And we may not meet them, but we at least have some goals and objectives we're pursuing to up the guarantee of our success. So that's my thought.
Mm-hmm. If we can just touch on net present value for a moment, what is this? I assume that's the net present value to the state, of course. And the net first term means we've got a cash outlay of some form or cost. Can you elaborate on that?
In subsection D on page 12, line 26, as a beginning point, we've defined net present value as meaning the discounted value of a future stream of cash flow. So if you take the cash flow that the state would expect to receive from a proposed project, you're obviously going to have the income stream associated with royalties, taxes, whatever other revenue streams come to the state through a proposed project, offset by whatever costs are experienced by the state. You take that net amount and you discount it by a given rate over time because the project happens over the course of, say, 30 years. And that's the net present value that we're trying to quantify on a project-by-project basis.
When we go to do that calculation and start moving cash flows around in time, we have to have gas to sell. How do you handle the applicant that has no gas?
What we have to assume, there'll be assumptions made that stay steady for all projects, and that's going to be assuming you take the project, you look at what its size is, and then you assume a throughput. You have to make an assumption of some gas flow, and you may make a range of assumptions depending upon what your range of projects are that you're looking at.
Senator Stedman, if I can elaborate on that. Clearly, when we have a blending of likelihood of success and net present value. As part of the net present value analysis, there's going to be different possible outcomes, whether you have a successful open season, a partially successful open season, whether that's going to result in a different capacity pipe or not. And as part of that analysis, we're going to have to make some probability assumptions associated with our estimate of the likelihood of a different track taking place. And so as part of the net present value analysis, there's going to be some probability estimates in there with regard to how likely a particular outcome is going to be. And so you end up with, to some extent, a multiplication factor if you have a project that is less likely to occur than another, that you end up with that lower likelihood playing out both in the net present value analysis as well as in the weighting factors. And so there is a overlap between these two things that's going to be the fact that we are looking into the future and trying to estimate what the income stream is going to be for projects that haven't yet been even, you know, fully designed.
Well, in the bill, earlier in the bill, it's set up for a 80-20 match past open season to the FERC certificate. To get from, my understanding is to get from time zero to the FERC certificate, you've got, if you go past those failed open seasons, you've got no gas. But then I'd assume on your application you'd have no gas. So the discount rate Are you going to substantially move that up for the risk level of versus someone that shows up with an application that has gas? I would think that the risk level or the discount rate using net present value would go right through the roof.
The discount rate is going to be set. We're going to look at each project along a series of discount rates, both what's in the bill and also additional ones. What's going to drive the end result that will be the same, I think, as what you described, is the fact that if we have a project that has a low likelihood of getting gas at an open season, then we're going to have to, from a probability standpoint, reduce the likelihood that they're going to get their project on time and along their success leg of their work plan. And so it's going to end up in the same place, that if we have a project that has a greater likelihood of getting gas at an open season, whether it's because it's pre-committed or whether because we have confidence in the attractiveness of their particular proposal, then it's going to have a higher probability of getting that cash flow in the time frame that provides the greatest value, both to the state and to the project. So if we have a project that, again, has a risky probability at an open season, and then we look at what the likeliness is of an unsuccessful open season and proceed that to that FERC certificate and the likelihood of a successful open season at that point, if we consider that to be low, then all of that's going to factor into a low net present value estimate, a low likelihood of success, and basically a very low ranked project.
And if it's the only project?
Then that's where the kicks in, where the commissioners have the discretion to decide that this isn't worth going forward with. It's not in the state's interest to move forward. That's why that discretion is retained by the commissioners to say, even if we have a qualifying or multiple qualifying applicants, if they do not meet the state's interest because primarily of the reasons that would be a low likelihood of success, then the commissioners aren't obligated to issue the license.
It's going to be interesting to look at the calculations for the fellow that has no gas when you're running discounted cash flow analysis. So we'll cross that bridge when we get there.
Senator Stedman, we recognize the challenge that's before us in terms of doing the analysis on these projects, and we also recognize that in the end we're going to have to be back here with you folks a year from now, hopefully, providing you with those numbers and the analysis that we've done and telling you why we've made the decision that we've made.
Okay. Please continue.
Section 180 at the bottom of page 12, line 28, and flowing over to the next page, addresses the manner in which the commissioners, after taking into consideration the public comments and after having evaluated the applications, will make a decision as to whether, having ranked the projects, any project merits being issued a license in light of the benefits to the state and its people from the resources. If they decide that a project does merit the granting of a license, they'll issue their determination with written findings. They'll publish a notice of their intent to issue a license, and that notice will be forwarded to the legislature, to the presiding officer of each house of the legislature for action in the following provision. If the commissioners review everything and decide that no application merits awarding of a license, they'll make that decision as well and issue their written notice and written finding as a basis for that determination. And for that type of a determination, that's where it ends. Basically, we say that's the final agency action at that juncture. Section 190 is a provision that has undergone a tremendous amount of revision since the introduction of the bill. This relates to the process for legislative approval of the proposed notice to issue the license. And as it stands today, it's the when each presiding officer of the House receives notice, then the Rules Committee of each House introduces a bill in the committee's respective chamber to provide for approval of the license to be issued by the commissioners. And the bill must be passed within 60 days after the last date of receipt by a presiding officer of the determination. Provision C lists what I'll call...
Senator Elton.
Back to B. I'm going to outline a scenario, and you can tell me if it's a serious one or not. But B provides the commissioner shall issue the license as soon as practicable after the effective date of the act approving the issuance of the license. An immediate effective date takes a supermajority vote in the legislature. What happens if we approve the bill but don't approve an immediate effective date? And I mean, if we don't approve the immediate effective date, it postpones the issuance of a license for 90 days. I mean, in other parts of this, we're waiving legislative rules. I mean, was there any discussion of waiving the supermajority vote needed for an immediate effective date?
No, you do that one. Go for that one.
Senator Elton, through the chair. The language of this provision was drafted by previous committees, and so that there wasn't a significant discussion about some of the parliamentary rigmarole that goes into these sorts of things. We have expressed our primary concern with the timeline. We recognize, and it was built into the original structure of AGEA, that there would be legislative review of the decision. And so we don't have any opposition to that. It's just a nature of ensuring that the timeline is met. And there's a certain amount of when we chose between the veto versus the approval requirement, what we recognize is that with an approval requirement, you have layers upon layers of possible potential delays, because it's a lot more difficult to get an action than it is to just have the license become effective if no action has occurred. And it is the scenario that you just painted that causes us concern with this type of approval structure, because frankly, we recognize that there are probably innumerable ways in which this process can be delayed, the approval process can be delayed because of some parliamentary hiccup, a commissioner or a committee member or committee chair does something. You know, there's a number of different things that we recognize are potential delaying parts. Getting right at the nature of the scenario that you painted, it would come down to a question of whether the licensee would feel enough confidence that the license will eventually be issued, that they would begin to expend the money necessary to begin work. I can't speak for them at that particular time, given the nature of the types of arrangements that they would have to make, contractual obligations they'd have to undertake, and the level of confidence, certainty that they would feel is in place, given the fact that the legislature had approved but had not yet become effective. It may end up being a moot point, because they may end up just saying, oh, that's good enough for us, you know, we'll know you'll eventually get around to giving us the license. It may be a significant hurdle, and we may end up losing the field season because of it. It's simply that we will have no ability to compel them to begin to act until the license is issued. And so it's just a matter of lack of control that causes us that kind of concern.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this subject, next year we're going to be going into a 90-day session, and I don't see any problems with this deadline if we're in session, but what happens if we're not in session?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair. If you're not in session, the one thing we do appreciate with the language that's been changed in the Senate Judiciary is that it is 60 days, calendar days, as opposed to legislative days, which means that the 60 days would encompass the time from the time the notice is provided to the call of a special session to the 30 days of the special session to completing the special session, assuming that an act is eventually approved. There would only be 30 days potentially during that time in which there would be sort of legislative in-session days. But in the end, we can't do anything until it's approved. And so whether it's 60 days, 90 days, 120 days, nothing moves until the approval takes place. And to a certain extent, the 60 days in here is simply a self-imposed deadline that can be missed, and it's just a matter of whether the commissioners decide to take the authority that is then presented with the expiration of that time to go back and start the RFA process all over again. And I would submit that if we were in a position where we had a licensee and the legislature had not ostensibly rejected it through not being able to get a majority in support of the project, if it was just a matter of getting everybody together and moving through the process, we would probably just blow right past whatever deadline is in here, because we can't do anything until it's approved. And that's the nature of our discomfort with this current structure that's provided here.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. Well, my assumption of everybody sitting around this table, this will be the largest decision we're making on behalf of the residents of the state. And if we collectively can't come to that decision, it probably should not be had. I mean, it's that important. I mean, if we can't be convinced by you and our fellow members that this is not the right project, then it's probably not the right project. So that doesn't give me any discomfort at all. I mean, it gives me great comfort. And, you know, in the past, I remember a lot. Some people sitting around this table fretted over whether the governor could just go sign it. And if the governor thought it was that good and wanted to go sign it, let her go sign it. I felt that way before. I feel that way today. And so, you know, and if the largest delay of this project is 30 days based on it being extended from 30 to 60 days, then golly, I'm a happy man. We'll get this thing done in about 6 years. So I hope that's the longest delay we experience in this project. So this doesn't make me uncomfortable at all. I think it's two elements in this case, the legislature and administration coming together on a good project. If it's a good one, we'll get it done. If it's not, we'll have to relook at it. And I think that's fair enough, and I think Alaskans would agree with that.
Senator Huggins, through the chair, I don't particularly disagree with you. I mean, I think from our vantage point, the reason why we have come forward with the AGEA at all is because we want this process to be one that is accepted and endorsed by the administration and the legislature together, both in the nature of the bill that we present and in the nature of the licensee that we select. And so in the end, I think, you know, we recognize that if there is a licensee that's selected that can't engender a majority of the legislature, then I think we do need to consider whether or not it's appropriate for us to go forward and how successful it could be if we have that kind of a split. It's simply a matter of recognizing that the decision-making process takes a long time, even when everybody understands the import and, to a certain extent, even the inevitability of a particular result. It's just a sense of wanting to make sure that you've crossed all your T's, dotted all your I's, and did the people's work. And it's simply a matter of an understanding between the administration and the legislature, both in our discussion about it this year and as we're going through it next year, that we're all recognizing that imperative. And that's the reason why we keep bringing it back, is to make sure that we're all on the same page, that we have two goals. One is to make sure we get the right applicant, right licensee. That's paramount. Next to that is that we give him the chance to get out there in summer 2008 and begin work. And that comes in right after that. And I believe in the end we're all going to be on the same page, but we just keep talking about it to make sure that that's reinforced.
I want to wrap up today, but go ahead, Senator.
Yeah, follow up, because I listened to a conversation today, and it gets to what actually comes to the legislature. My assumption, it will be at least one license application, but if the legislature wanted to look at more than one, that's within the spirit, or does that need to be delineated? Is there anything that precludes that?
Senator Huggins, what the administration would be putting forward is its justification for why it ranked a specific project first compared to other projects. So in the course of our evaluation of saying this is the superior project because it will necessarily be in part in comparison to some of the other, you know, applicants. So you'll see it as a frame, giving a frame of reference for why this is the superior application. We won't be sitting out and putting out each application and sort of de novo walking through how each one was ranked per se, but you will hear about the other applications through with reference to why this one is superior compared to the others.
Senator Huggins, through the chair. There will be two different sets that you'll receive potentially, depending upon what we receive. The first is the finding that will evaluate the qualifying applications. These are the ones that when we talked about the Mayshall issue that met the requirements. And as part of that, we're obligated to determine the net present value along those different discount rates. And you will receive that information for all of the qualifying applications, and then you will receive a discussion of the likelihood of success elements for each of those, and in the end, a justification for how they ended up being ranked in a particular order, and the project that ranks the highest is the one that will be submitted as the proposed licensee. You will also have access to the applications that were rejected because they were non-qualifying. They did not meet the state's requirements, and those will be provided to you, available to you, but they will not be part of that evaluation process.
Just not to belabor, but Commissioner Gavin, what I heard you say is that it really will be a side-by-side of one or more applications, a product that we will see. Okay, that's good.
Okay, with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap up today. We're going to come back tomorrow at 9 a.m. We should finish up walking through the bill in the morning. We've got some interesting issues in the morning to deal with, dealing with credit and five-year extensions, along with the inducements, a few things, so we'll be busy. But tomorrow at the LBNA, LBNA is sponsoring a meeting with Fred Rich on Wednesday, House Finance Room from 4 to 7 p.m. I think it would be advisable for as many of the finance members to attend as possible, along with the public by television. Mr. Rich is going to go over pipeline financing. He's a D.C. attorney with Sullivan and Cromwell. He's formerly briefed the Department of Energy, OMB, FERC, U.S. Treasury, on financing projects. So it should be interesting. It'll tie in also tomorrow with some of the subject matter we're going to talk about here that's in the bill. So hopefully we can kind of put that package together. One of the critical issues that we'll be discussing is the financing of the gas line project and how it works and where the risk levels are, not only for the overall project, but where the risk levels or where the risk lies in it from the state's perspective.
Mr. Chair, when and where again?
That is 4 o'clock. Down to the other body's finance room. It's 4 to 7. It's LBNA sponsored. And hopefully everybody will be able to attend. So tomorrow, we'll see everybody back here at 9 a.m. We'll make sure there's a sign out there so you remember what room to go to. And we'll continue walking through the bill. Meeting adjourned.